KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Health Dialogues. In this hour, allergies and asthma. From pollen to peanuts, smog to cigarette smoke, millions of Americans have bad reactions to things they breathe or eat.
My day will be fine, and then suddenly I'll be sneezing and my eyes will be red. My nose will be gushing.
Allergies and asthma cause bigger problems than just sneezing and wheezing, and people living in public housing are especially vulnerable.
So if you see a house that's covered with molds, got leaky faucets, and you see roaches everywhere, you can understand why everybody has asthma.
Coming up, what you should know about allergies and asthma and why so many people suffer from both. I'm Scott Schaefer, and this is Health Dialogues, a statewide broadcast of the California Report and KQED Public Radio.
I'm unfortunately one of those huge number of people that are allergic to nuts. It is as if your throat is closing up on you.
I have allergy reactions to certain kinds of plants and flowers and buds and blooms and stuff like that.
I was on a camping trip and we were walking up a big hill and I just couldn't, everybody else was walking really fast and I tried to catch up and then my heart started beating fast and I couldn't breathe. And then I had to be taken to the hospital and then they told me that I had asthma because I didn't know I had asthma at the time.
I'm allergic to Italian breakfast sausage. Every time I go to breakfast, I gotta watch out what I eat.
Yeah, I have allergies. It's painful at times because I gotta keep sniffing and scratching my nose and trying to make it go away, but it don't go away. It just keep coming back and back.
In the nighttime, sometimes when I'm sleeping, I'll have an attack, or when I'm walking or laughing a lot, I'll have an attack and it start wheezing and short of breath, and I hate it. It's awful.
Just a few examples of how allergies and asthma affect some of the people we spoke to recently. It isn't hard to find someone who suffers from one or the other or both of these lung problems. We're allergic to pollen and ragweed or to foods like peanuts and shellfish or cats or penicillin. It's a long list of things that make us sneeze, break out in a rash, or worse. Allergies and their pulmonary cousin asthma keep kids at home from school. They send people to emergency rooms, and in extreme cases, they can even kill you. So this hour, we're talking about both allergies and asthma, what's causing the surge in cases, why are poor people and African Americans so susceptible to asthma, and what's the best way to treat it. We'll start with allergies. Some 50 million Americans are allergic to something or other. Commentator Paul Staley found out he had an allergy when he least expected it.
It was May 1996. While out running some errands, I stopped in at a local cafe for a smoothie. When asked if I wanted any additives, I asked for bee pollen to be thrown in the blender. I didn't know much about it, only that it's supposed to be an energy booster, and that seemed like a good idea that afternoon. But by the time I got back home, I realized that something was wrong. My skin was itchy all over, and there was a funny ringing in my ears. I checked myself out in the mirror and saw that my face was puffing up. I took two Benadryl, but when my ears began to swell shut, I started to worry. Now, I'm a pretty low-maintenance guy medically. Wait and it'll go away had always been an effective approach. Certain times a year, my eyes would water and I'd sneeze, but I didn't consider myself somebody with serious hay fever. But that afternoon, as I wondered what to do, I thought of my friend Robin, who was acutely allergic to peanuts. Just a few weeks earlier, she had left a dinner party and rushed to the emergency room because there had been peanuts in the salad. So remembering what Robin had done, I drove myself to the nearest hospital. When I got there, I had to take an elevator to the emergency room, and on the way up, I started to feel woozy and lightheaded. When the doors opened, I stepped out and fell like a tree. My chin took out a flower pot on the way down, and I came to with a mouthful of blood. Some people helped me up, and I remember telling them that I was having an allergic reaction. And then it all went blank. What I remember next are two simultaneous sensations. On the one hand, I felt like I was falling down a dark well, while at the same time I was wrestling with some invisible people. When I regained consciousness, I realized that the people I was resisting were the ER personnel holding me down as I convulsed. The dark well? Who knows? I do know that the medics told me that I got there just in time. In the days after this incident, people asked me if I knew I was allergic to bees, but that wasn't the problem. The harvesting process for bee pollen consists of trapping bees before they return to the hive and shaking the pollen loose. The bee is merely the delivery vehicle. No, what happened to me that day was that a guy prone to mild bouts of hay fever asked for and then ingested a massive dose of the very thing to which he was allergic. For Health Dialogues, I'm Paul Staley.
Paul Staley is a real estate developer living in San Francisco, and we all know he's not alone with his allergy, and so let's find out more. We turn to Catherine Gundling. She's director of the Allergy and Immunology Clinic at UC San Francisco. Let me begin just by asking you, Catherine, what was going on with Paul Staley when he ingested all that bee pollen? What was happening in his body?
Sure. Paul is describing a classic anaphylactic reaction. It's something we call anaphylaxis, and it means basically that his body was giving out. He was having a very extreme reaction, allergic reaction, one that we call type 1 hypersensitivity, which means an immediate type of reaction that can be very serious and does kill people every year. It can consist of wheezing, shortness of breath, so difficulty with breathing. Some people develop skin blotches, itchy red bumps, swelling, and the blood vessels can collapse in the worst case, and sometimes people die from it, and it sounds like he got care just in time.
He certainly did. Now, he says in that piece we heard that he has hay fever and that the bee pollen was kind of just a larger-than-usual exposure to it. How common is that, where we have maybe a low-level or medium-level allergy to something, and then suddenly we get exposed to a whole bunch of it without thinking about it?
Sure, it is common, and that's actually one of the reasons that people come in to see us, is when they have a more severe reaction than usual. And there are case reports of this bee pollen anaphylaxis. Sometimes people can get a really big dose of pollen to which they're allergic.
Now, why would he or anyone else be allergic to one thing but not another? What is it that makes us allergic to bee pollen or cats or dust mites?
Sure, that's a really very important question, and one that's the subject of much research. We know that genetics is involved. We know that environmental exposures are involved. But exactly what it is that turns the immune system on or off to these things is still a very important and not fully answered question.
And so we can test for it. We can find out what we might be allergic to, but we're not sure why.
Right. So in some cases, we do know why. We can tell exactly what's going on with the immune system, and that's one of the things that the testing really helps with. So, for example, when people use the term allergies, usually they just mean an adverse reaction of some sort. But the one thing that we really want to be sure of is whether or not it's this type 1 or immediate hypersensitivity, because that's the one that can kill you, whether it's a peanut that you ingest, whether it's a bee sting allergy, an anaphylactic reaction, or bee pollen, or a drug reaction like penicillin. That's the one that really can kill you. And so, fortunately, we are able to test to see if people have an immune response consistent with that.
But we don't do that kind of testing routinely.
We do.
Really?
Yes.
So if someone came to your clinic, but I mean, just in general, you go for a checkup every now and then, you haven't had a reaction to something, it's not part of a standard test, is it?
No, it's not part of a standard test if you're visiting the primary care doctor. But sometimes when people visit their doctor and they report different types of symptoms, such as itchy red splotches on the skin or swellings or immediate reactions to things of unclear origin, those are the people who then often are referred on for testing.
So for most of us, we have a little hay fever. I suffer from that a little bit. We don't need to go to a specialist, right?
No.
Unless it really gets out of control or we have an extreme reaction.
That's correct. The large majority of cases, hay fever, particularly if you know what time of year, if it's seasonal and it's related to pollen circulating in the air, most of those are easily preventable or treatable with very few things. It's only in the more severe cases that people are referred on to the allergy immunology physicians.
You know, it seems like some years I won't have any hay fever, mm-hmm. and then other years I do. Some years it's really bad, some years not so much. What accounts for that difference?
Sure. So you're talking about hay fever. Another term for which we use is allergic rhinitis, and that's predominantly the facial symptoms. And people can also have asthma at that time. It's the same type of process, only lower in the lungs. That's one cause of asthma. But it depends on Mother Nature. If it's a warm year, a sunny year, if the rain stops, if the rain starts, all of these things can affect the amount of pollen that's in the air. And depending on your specific allergies, at some time of year, whether it's spring, fall, winter, when that particular type of pollen or substance is in the air, that's when you will react.
Now, of course, everyone's talking about climate change, and in some cases it means more precipitation, it can mean warmer temperatures sooner during the year. Is that in any way related to what seems to be an increase in the number of allergies that are being reported?
I think it would be hard to tell until we have more years to talk about, because in any given year, allergies per se, hay fever type symptoms, can be worse or better depending upon the weather. But once you start noticing trends over the years, then you start wondering if there's something different. And certainly any change in weather can affect the amount of pollen in the air, and that will affect people's symptoms.
So it does make a certain amount of sense.
Sure.
Yeah. Who is most at risk of an allergic reaction? Is it, are kids more susceptible to it, older folks?
So as far as hay fever is concerned, anyone can develop it. It can start at a very young age, or it can start just during adulthood. And partly that depends on the trigger. So pollen allergies can occur at a young age or as an adult. And if you move to a new place and you're exposed to a new substance, sometimes within a year or two, you can develop allergies to something else in the air. You can develop a drug allergy, allergic reaction, at any time in your life. And you don't necessarily have to be someone predisposed to hay fever, asthma, those types of illnesses to get that type of reaction. So it can happen to anybody, but in general, people who have it in the family are more likely to have it.
And so it is genetic.
It is. There is a genetic component.
Yeah. And are kids who have it, are the symptoms typically less severe, or is it really just really depend on the person and the exposure level?
It can be just as severe in kids. The difference is that kids often have more nasal symptoms, and also adults have better sinuses, more formed sinuses, and adults tend to be more prone to sinusitis. So in adults, you tend to see a little bit more of the sinus complications of allergic rhinitis, and maybe some of the asthma too. Also depends on if you have what we call perennial allergens, or triggers that can cause symptoms year-round, such as dust mite, cat dander, things that will cause you to have symptoms any day of the year. Those people tend to be particularly prone to symptoms because their trigger is 24 hours a day.
And what is it about dust mites? Is it that you're actually allergic to the mite itself, or is it something else?
Yeah, dust mites have proteins in them to which many people are allergic. And dust mites love a nice, warm, humid place to live, and they feed off of human and animal dead skin cells. So what better place to live than your pillow, where you're constantly breathing this warm, humid air, and you're shedding a nice supply of food in human skin cells every night. And so some people who have ongoing problems with hay fever, sinusitis, asthma, actually have dust mite allergy, and this is something we can test for.
So unless we do something about it, our pillow is full of dust mites?
Absolutely.
So get a dust mite cover?
Dust mite pillow cover, dust mite mattress cover. And one of the things that we do when we see patients who have dust mite allergy is we sit down and talk with them about preventive measures. And that is absolutely key for many people, preventive measures and avoidance of any of these things that can trigger the symptoms.
I was living for 1 year in Sacramento a few years ago, and it seemed at the time like I became allergic to something while I was living up there. There's a lot of rice fields up there. They burn the fields during the summer. But the allergies have stuck with me. And so I'm wondering if living in a different place or at a different time of the year can trigger something. And if so, even if you leave that place, can the allergy stay with you?
Yes. So it's a great question. Different geographical locations have different levels of pollen in the air, and depending on the humidity and the heat, they may have more or less dust mite, for example. Another thing that occurs in the Central Valley is they tend to have more of a mold spore in the soil called alternaria, and when the fields are plowed, these mold spores come up, and that can trigger asthma, allergic rhinitis type symptoms. Once you're sensitized to something, particularly if you've had a big exposure to it and you're sensitized, no matter where you live, if you're exposed again, you can have those symptoms.
Well, I want to bring in another guest now. Stephen Zilber is a licensed acupuncturist and herbalist. He's managing partner of Whole Health Associates Center for Integrative Medicine in San Rafael, where he treats people with allergies. And Stephen Zilber, what would you say to somebody who came to you with sneezing and wheezing? What would you do?
Well, we need to do a couple of different things. We both want to identify what's going on in that individual's body. So basically, the way I look at an allergy, it's a hypersensitivity response. Their immune system is keyed up too tightly. So they're having an excessive response to things that normally shouldn't cause the general population a problem, whether it's pollens or dust or danders. So we need to identify what are the things that might be triggering the immune system to have this over-exuberant reaction.
Now, would you treat them with acupuncture, herbs? How would you approach it, and how would you decide what to use?
Well, I use a combination of different approaches, and it really depends on what's going on for the individual. So some of the things that Dr. Gundling was mentioning as far as reducing environmental exposure, very, very important. So using air filters, barriers, trying to reduce the exposure is a first step. But then also identifying, is their system being triggered by foods and food allergens, by environmental triggers such as pollens, dusts, molds? And then there are different ways to test that, both using laboratory testing as well as testing that we do in the office.
And what would you do for someone or not do for someone say, a Western physician with more traditional means at their disposal that they might do? How is your treatment different?
Well, I'm working on two levels, both to treat the symptoms. So in the same way that someone might take an antihistamine, for example, there are comparable both Chinese herbal formulas and other nutritional support that can help treat the symptoms. So the sneezing, burning, itchy eyes, runny nose, to help with that. But more so what I try to do is balance the body and the underlying immune imbalance. And so it's not just a matter of treating the symptoms, because like with an antihistamine, as soon as you stop taking it, the symptoms will tend to come back. So instead, we try to go in and rebalance or harmonize the immune system so that we treat the underlying allergy at its root.
You're listening to Health Dialogues, and we're talking this hour about allergies and asthma. Our guests in this part of the show, Catherine Gundling, who is director of the Allergy and Immunology Clinic at UC San Francisco, and Stephen Zilber, licensed acupuncturist and herbalist based up in San Rafael in Marin County. Let me ask you, Catherine Gundling, many people will go to the doctor and get shots for allergies. What are those shots, and how effective are they?
I think what you're referring to is what a lot of people call allergy shots. It's a form of the substances to which people are allergic can also retrain the immune system. And this was something, interestingly, that was described early in the 20th century. And the unfortunate people who originally tried it on themselves gave themselves an anaphylactic reaction because they just injected themselves with a huge dose of pollen. And they discovered quickly that, in fact, something is triggered by these pollens and that you can affect the body tremendously. And so over the years, really early in the 20th century, so this is actually a fairly old therapy as far as medicine goes, it was understood that if you start with very low doses and work your way up, actually injecting the things to which people are allergic, that you can retrain the immune system. And in the last 10 years, we've actually begun to understand what happens in the immune system and how the regulation of the immune system goes back to normal with this particular type of therapy. And interestingly, we have some new therapies coming along that are going to be much less painful and much shorter and very, very effective for this.
When you say less painful, you mean no shots?
No shots, yeah.
Yeah.
There is actually a type of immunotherapy or allergy shots. There's a version that you can take as a liquid by mouth that's available in Europe. It doesn't have quite the benefit that the shots do, probably. This is something being studied. But that's one way that it can be done for some people. And there are some other new therapies coming down the pike that will just target very specifically what the immune disorder is and correct it.
Stephen Zilber, to what extent do you discuss with your patients these alternative kinds of treatments that Catherine Gundling is describing?
We talk about a wide range of different treatments. And usually it'll be what I'll use is a combination of acupuncture. And acupuncture actually has now been shown in clinical journal accepted studies to be effective for allergic rhinitis, both in adults and children. Using herbal formulas, and these are time-tested formulas that have been used for now thousands of years successfully for treating symptoms. And then, as I mentioned, also a lot of my focus is looking at nutrition and diet, and how that serves as an underlying base for some of the things that can trigger these allergic tendencies.
And what's your attitude toward the kinds of allergy shots that she described?
They can be effective for some people. They can be painful, and they take a long amount of time. So I oftentimes can find, especially for children, they tend to respond fairly quickly to acupuncture and some of these alternative treatments and have very, very high level of success in my office treating allergies, both seasonal and persistent allergies, in both children and adults.
Catherine, one of the things that gets used for hay fever are these nasal sprays like Flonase, for example. What is Flonase, and are there any risks to using it on a regular basis? Because you see the ads on TV, and it's like, oh, you can use it every day. Is there any downside with that?
Sure. So what we usually start with in people who have a little bit of drainage or some symptoms, often if they are generally healthy, we'll recommend saline irrigation. And saline irrigation is all that many people need. They're happy. They feel well.
What does that mean? Just salt water?
Just salt water. And I'm not talking about a little tiny mist, but really irrigating the nose. And a lot of times that's something that helps people tremendously and can also help to reduce or prevent problems with sinus infections. So before we progress to some of those other medications, just to say that there are some very simple measures you can take that are non-medicated that are often all that people need. The nasal spray that you're asking about, something like the Flonase, that one in particular is a nasal corticosteroid. It's a very low dose. Those particular medications were developed so that you wouldn't have to go into your doctor once a year or twice a year and get a shot of cortisone. Cortisone is a medication that suppresses the immune system, and it works for allergies, but it affects every cell in your body, and we prefer that people not have to use that. So nasal sprays were developed so that you could deliver something locally with a minimum of adverse effects. And for most people, they are quite safe and very beneficial. If you need them for 2 or 3 weeks of the year or 2 or 3 months of the year, generally they're fine. But it's important to use the technique correctly, to understand how to use it, what it's for, and what the limitations are.
There are reports of food allergies increasing in the past few years. What's your sense of what's going on there? Is it just a better diagnosis, or is there something changing in our food?
Sure. Food allergy is another extremely important topic, and this is exactly where we would want to address the issue. Is this immediate hypersensitivity the kind that can kill you, or might this be some other type of food adverse reaction? So, for example, lactose intolerance, where a lot of people just can't drink milk products, that's actually not a food allergy. It's just that our bodies don't produce an enzyme that's required to break down the milk sugar, and some people will get gas and bloating and diarrhea. So the food allergies that we worry about are the kind that are this immediate hypersensitivity that can cause a reaction similar to what we heard at the top of the program, this anaphylactic reaction. And most people either know someone who has that kind of food allergy or have heard about it. Food allergies have become more common in recent years. They occur in about 8% of children under the age of 5, but there are 4 or 5 foods that cause almost all of these kinds of food allergies in young children. In adults...
Wait, let me just stop you. What are they?
Yeah, they would be egg, milk, wheat, soy, fish, and perhaps peanut. And in adults, I would add to that list not so much the egg, milk, and soy, although we can see any of those, but fish, shellfish, tree nuts, and peanuts in adults. Mm. And about 40% of adults think they have that kind of food allergy, and in reality, it's only about 3 to 5%, and we can determine that.
Stephen Zilber, anything to add in terms of why you think we're seeing more of those kinds of food-related allergies?
I think it's a combination of things. We are seeing an overall load of toxins and antigens in our environment in general. So things that our bodies are being exposed to as far as pesticides and pollutants, which stimulate, which trigger our immune systems. As far as foods are concerned, I'm not an expert on genetically engineered crops, but it makes sense that as we're moving towards more of monocropping, and we are actually reducing down the variety of foods and food proteins we're exposed to, it's increasing the likelihood that our immune systems are being repeatedly exposed to the same substances and getting sensitized to it.
We're short on time, but Catherine Gulling, I want to ask you just quickly, if you could, to address what some people call the hygiene hypothesis of allergies. What is it, and how seriously do you take it?
The question is whether dirt is good or bad. And it may be that in the last 100 to 150 years that our increased cleanliness and our ability to stave off disease has made us actually a little more susceptible to other immunologic problems. So it may be that dirt is good and that we need to allow our kids to play in the dirt And that's sort of the gist of the hygiene hypothesis.
So throw out the hand sanitizers?
Well, that's another question.
That's another question altogether. We're going to have to save that for another time. All right, thanks to both of you. Catherine Gundling, Associate Clinical Professor and Director of the Allergy and Immunology Clinic at UC San Francisco, and Stephen Zilber, Licensed Acupuncturist and Herbalist, a Managing Partner of Whole Health Associates Center for Integrative Medicine in San Rafael. Coming up, a related part of this story, asthma. Allergies are the trigger for more than half of the 5 million Californians who have asthma. And in the second part of our show, what's causing this epidemic of asthma and why low-income folks and African Americans are so susceptible to it and what can be done to manage the disease better. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Health Dialogues. And welcome back to Health Dialogues. I'm Scott Schaefer. Glad you're with us. The first half of the show, we talked about allergies. Now a related lung problem, asthma. In fact, 70% of people with asthma also have allergies. Asthma rates have increased steadily in California over the last several decades, especially among African-American children. While scientists still don't know exactly what causes the disease or how to cure it, several studies have linked air pollution to asthma, and scientists know that smog and living close to freeways can increase the risk of children being diagnosed. But an asthma attack can be triggered by other things, too, like mold and dust mites. One program in South Los Angeles aims to help parents of asthmatic children find those triggers in their homes and get rid of them. Sarah Varney has more.
Maribel Larios walks down a driveway past a small stucco house in Compton, a poor and violent city south of downtown Los Angeles. Behind the house is a tiny apartment attached to a garage. Iron bars molded into flamboyant curlicues cover the windows and screen door. Maribel carries a gray plastic bucket filled with cockroach traps and plastic mattress covers. She knocks on the door.
Buenos dias.
Buenos dias. ¿Cómo
está? Maribel is a health worker from St. John's, a local health clinic, and is here to see if something in this tiny one-bedroom apartment is triggering asthma attacks for this family. The five children who live here with their parents all have asthma. Maribel begins asking the children's mother, Erica Mesa, a litany of questions, while Grandma Alicia and Aunt Veronica corral the three youngest kids onto the couch.
Does anyone smoke at home?
No.
Not even outside?
No.
The stuff, toys they have?
No, they don't have.
They don't have.
The dizzying list of questions reveals what scientists know about the causes of asthma. Not a whole lot. They do know that certain things can trigger an attack, like air pollution, cigarette smoke, mold, bee pollen, pets, dust mites, and cockroaches. And they know asthma is much more common in places like Compton, inner-city neighborhoods with African-American and Latino residents. In one corner of the Mesas' living room are bunk beds covered with brightly colored blankets. A few feet away, bath towels and cotton tablecloths are spread over two small couches.
That's a very good idea that you cover your furniture with blankets.
Or just keep on taking them off.
Yes. You can wash covers regularly and minimize dust mites in the furniture.
Maribel scans the floors and ceiling for cockroaches. There are some small holes that the landlord's been promising to fix, but no signs of activity. Erica says their roaches come when it's hot, which means they'll be coming soon. Maribel reaches into her plastic bucket and pulls out a roach motel, then a rat trap.
We can give you the stuff to clean the cockroaches, like the gel,
yeah,
that you say. You don't have evidence of rats or?
No, not yet.
These questions would be embarrassing for any mother proud of her clean home. Maribel says when families come to St. John's Health Clinic, they often say they don't have cockroaches or dust mites or rats because they don't want to be thought of as dirty. But a UCLA study found that of poor California families with asthma, one out of three of those families live with cockroaches. Doctors at St. John's say it's futile to establish an asthma treatment program for their patients when those kids live in homes infested with dust mites, roaches, and mold. The clinic is studying to see if sending health workers like Maribel into homes will help reduce asthma triggers, lower hospitalization from asthma attacks, and increase compliance with medication. Erica pulls a small plastic asthma machine off a bookshelf and sets it on the couch. She walks to the kitchen and opens a cabinet next to the sink.
I have all the medicine in here.
Inside is a deep 2-foot-long plastic bin full of blue tubing and packets of asthma medicine. Erica's 4-year-old son, Nikki, sits compliantly on the couch, inhaling the vaporized asthma medicine. The treatment takes about 10 minutes. Grandmother Alicia says it's tough for her daughter to find a babysitter for the 5 asthmatic children.
Lo primero que le dice, oh, si tus niños tienen asma, te vamos a cobrar más dinero.
She said when she's been trying to give the children to somebody to take care of them because she wants to work, they say they will charge more expensive because they are sick.
So Erica can't work outside the home, and the family relies on her husband's income from construction jobs. But Erica says even if she could get a job, she would worry constantly about an asthma attack. When her oldest son, now 8, first started having trouble breathing, she gave him cough medicine for a few weeks. Then one morning, his lips turned purple, and Erica rushed him to the emergency room. That was the first of many trips to the ER, not just with that son, but her other children as well.
And I really would like to know why, where did they get that problem, or where does it come from? You know, because none of my family has, none of my brothers or cousins or nobody, it's just me with my kids.
And you feel like you're doing everything you can to keep the house clean, to make sure that the triggers that Maribel pointed out don't exist in your home.
Yes, I try, but it's like they just get the attacks and I say, whoa, I clean, I change the blankets, I do everything I can, and they just keep on getting them. So I say, oh, I don't know, it's just really, really frustrating.
For Health Dialogues, I'm Sarah Varney.
And joining us now is Dr. Harold Farber. He's a pediatric pulmonologist at Kaiser Permanente in Napa, Solano. He's also author of Control Your Child's Asthma, a breakthrough program for treatment and management of childhood asthma, and also David Nunez, chief of the California Asthma Public Health Initiative. And let me begin by asking you, Hal Farber, what's the first thing you do when you see a young person come into your office? Maybe they have asthma, but it looks like they have symptoms, perhaps. What do you do?
First is define their pattern. Or do they have a history of severe problems, or do they have a history of mild occasional problems? Then start looking at what their triggers are, what their experience with treatment is, how they focus on that, how they use their medications. And also an important thing, as mentioned earlier, checking lung function is important to see how open or closed the breathing tubes are. And we're also looking at assessment of triggers, environmental testing, and looking at allergy testing is important, too, as a very brief overview.
And why are kids more susceptible? Does it have to do with what we were talking about in the first half, about allergies and young people's lungs being a little more susceptible and less able to deal with those stresses?
That's a very interesting question. We know that asthma is much more common in the extremes of age. It's much more common in young children, and it's much more common in the elderly. I think, to some extent, our lungs are more vulnerable then. We tend to hit our peak lung function at age 16, and it's down from there. So we find on the extremes from there, we find more problems.
And when you do that assessment, looking at triggers and patterns and so on, do you see what are some things in terms of poverty levels and genetics or race, ethnicity? Are there things you look for depending on the nature of the person in your office?
Well, one of the things I look for in the nature of the person are what are their goals in therapy? Are they like... to some extent in our vignette, focusing on crisis care, or have I got them moved to looking at control care, and how do we prevent the next crisis? When I think about things in approaching asthma, as you mentioned, there are huge disparities based on socioeconomic status and based on ethnicity. When you look at asthma hospitalization rates, they're 10 times higher in the Oakland flatlands than in the foothills. The lowest hospitalization rates for asthma in New York among children are in the Upper East Side. The highest hospitalization rates, an order of magnitude higher, are just a few blocks north in Harlem in the South Bronx. And these have been shown over and over and over. Asthma, hospitalization, ER visits, mortality rates, at least 5 times higher among people of color than people of European ancestry.
And would you guess that the most important factor in that is socioeconomic status and living conditions, or is there something genetic, perhaps, that's related to the differences among different races and ethnic groups?
Well, clearly race is more than just 5 different groups and is
sure.
A very broad concept. I think looking at genetic differences is something that is important and is something that research is just starting on now and just starting to cut the surface on. But clearly socioeconomic status plays a role. There was a very nicely done study on asthma mortality that found the racial ethnic differences to be prominent in low-income communities, but pretty much go away when you go into high-income communities.
David Nunez, there have been reports and studies. Some folks have called the rise in asthma cases an epidemic. What's your take on why we're seeing more of it in recent years?
Well, I think as was commented in the first segment, there has been a worldwide increase in not just asthma, but all other forms of allergic disease, including allergic rhinitis and eczema. And this has been a worldwide phenomenon. I think that really it is an epidemic that we're facing, given the high numbers of folks who are affected, particularly children. And the numbers, while they seem to be stabilizing, they're still very high. We're talking about some 5 million folks in California who've been diagnosed with asthma and about 3 million who have had asthma symptoms in the last year. Many of these are folks who are not under good control and end up, you know, frequently using urgent care services such as the emergency room and the hospital.
And so what accounts for so many people having it?
I think that, as we heard before, we really don't know. I think there are a number of interesting hypotheses. Certainly the hygiene hypothesis has been mentioned. Some experts have correlated the global warming phenomena with increased levels of pollen production and tying that as perhaps one of the things that's triggered it. The bottom line is that we don't know what's causing the epidemic, and we still don't know how to prevent or cure asthma. But the good news is that we do have a lot of information about how to manage and control it so that folks aren't affected, so they can lead high-quality lives.
And Hal Farber, tell us about that management. How do you go about it, and what do you tell parents?
I focus on what I call the three lines of defense, starting with managing the environment, finding the triggers that can be controlled and reduced. And often it's in the home that you find the worst triggers, not trying to excuse the stuff outside, and that clearly does play a role. But often you have the worst things in the home. If somebody is smoking in the home, if a parent is smoking, if a family member is smoking, if you have a pet that you're allergic to, if you have dust mites if you're allergic to, if you have mold, if you're using a gas stove for heat, if you're using a fireplace, sometimes if your neighbors are using a fireplace, all those things can contribute. We break that down into what I call irritants, the smoke, chemicals, infections, and the allergens, the animal danders, dust mite, mold, mildew. The irritants are a problem for everybody, and allergens are a problem for people who are allergic to them. The next step is what I call managing the breathing tubes. To the extent that I can't get their breathing tubes normal with just environmental control alone, the next step is to use medications to make the breathing tubes less sensitive, to tell them, chill out, act like you don't have asthma, pretend like you're normal. Don't get bent out of shape about all this stuff. Looking at a strategy of prevention and getting away from a strategy of crisis care.
And I would think that the management of asthma could be a fairly complicated matter depending on what the triggers are.
Mm-hmm.
And so how difficult is it to get a family or a person to comply with the management plan that you come up with?
Well, you start simple. You start with the things that are the biggest problems and the easiest to change. I often look at smoke and smoke exposure as very big things. And tobacco addiction with current medications is very, very treatable. And while a lot of people can just go cold turkey, by the time they get to me, we're talking about a drug that is more addictive than heroin and is often very difficult to kick. So by offering appropriate treatment for tobacco addiction with effective strategies and medications, we can often help a lot there. We can identify other things such as the wood smoke, such as the allergens, and discuss what they are willing to do within what can be done. And often we can arrive at strategies that work within the family and within the individual situation.
David Nunez, your program is funded with tobacco tax money. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And that makes a certain amount of sense. Is there enough money available to deal with the explosion of asthma in California, or are there other pots of money as well?
Well, clearly we're barely scratching the surface in terms of what we're doing. We currently have programs in 17 community health centers in which we're largely focusing on childhood asthma and really providing resources to improve the quality of clinical care for asthma, but also providing asthma educators, community health workers, to go into the homes to provide real individualized asthma education that many folks aren't getting, and then to really help them deal with identified triggers, to really reduce those triggers.
What do you do if you're in a family with living in public housing, and you realize, see, this, you know, this child is allergic to dust mites? You need to get new pillows, dust mite covers. Those things can cost money.
Absolutely.
So what do you do? What do they do?
Well, I think that's one of the problems with the current healthcare system, is that allergy-proofing materials such as impermeable covers often are not covered by health insurance plans. And so folks are having to pay out-of-pocket costs, or they're having to rely on programs such as ours that provide those things free of charge. For other more difficult things like mold or rodents, what you really need to do is identify a clear history of those triggers being involved, and that would often involve skin testing or allergen testing. And then oftentimes it involves advocacy on the part of the child's physician, tenants' right groups, et cetera, to assess how to best remediate those types of triggers in the housing.
Hal Farber, as we're talking about asthma and the explosion of cases, we also have this simultaneous epidemic of obesity, especially mm-hmm. among young people. Any relation between those two things?
Most definitely. Obesity is associated with increase in asthma rates. And in terms of why that is, we're just starting to scrape the surface. What one of the things that we're finding is that in folks who are obese and overweight, we're finding increase in levels of what we call inflammatory mediators, things that stimulate inflammation and stimulate asthma, to be in their bloodstream and part of their body. So possibly part of being obese is having an increase in the level of inflammation in your body, and that could be in part triggering asthma. There also may be many other factors as well.
I want to bring in a third guest. Bonnie Holmes Jen is lobbyist for the American Lung Association of California. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Let me ask you, what are the Lung Association's top priorities, top three priorities when it comes to public policy and how it relates to these issues we're talking about?
Well, in terms of our work on air pollution and asthma, one of our chief priorities for years has been to reduce diesel pollution, because diesel pollution is an asthma trigger and, in fact, can be specifically linked to tens of thousands of asthma attacks every year, depending on what type of diesel equipment you're looking at.
And so we're talking about kids, people living in inner cities, near freeways, major traffic routes?
Well, I mean, air pollution, ozone pollution, and diesel pollution are both triggers for asthma. Soot in the air from diesel trucks, trains, from boats, from all of locomotives, all of these sources are important triggers for asthma. There's a great concern about especially families, children living close to freeways. Vehicles, of course, do emit particle pollution, which also triggers asthma. Basically, we need to transition our vehicle fleet to cleaner fuels. We need to retrofit. You know, we need to put devices on existing diesel equipment and diesel trucks to substantially reduce the pollution until we can change out those trucks and get newer, cleaner versions on the road. We have a lot of work to do. It takes a tremendous investment of funding and from industry and also from some public funds. But we need to reduce diesel pollution at the ports, on the roads. We need to convert our vehicle fleet.
What kind of progress are you making in those places, in those areas you talk about?
We are making progress. California has some important programs. For example, one program called the Carl Moyer Air Quality Program, which provides funding through the air districts to actually pay the incremental cost, the in-between cost of buying cleaner equipment and replacing those old diesel trucks or diesel irrigation pumps or diesel-powered boats or trains. So we do have some important programs. We're actually, the state budget also will be including new funding from the bond, the 1B transportation bond that everybody voted, that many of us voted for in the fall. And those bond fundings will actually provide $1 billion to reduce diesel pollution at the ports and sources that are related to the ports. So there's been a lot of progress made, but there's still a long way to go.
You bet. David Nunez, this is not a problem that affects everybody equally in terms of the geography of California. Some of the worst air in California is in the L.A. Basin, Riverside, the Inland Empire. Do you focus your programs in areas of California where there's the greatest need?
Absolutely. One of the criteria for selecting clinics is that they really are in high-need areas, that they are experiencing health disparities, or that they're confronting disparities in terms of exposures to pollutants. And so you'll find that many of those features are present in the clinics that we serve. As I said before, we're really only reaching a small number of areas in need because of the limitation of the financing of this sort of care. But what I wanted to say was that there is some compelling research looking at the business case for investing in good quality asthma education and in environmental management interventions. There really is evidence of good cost savings and that these types of programs are cost effective. So it really makes sense to start looking at how we can finance these sorts of good quality interventions through our current healthcare system.
When you say cost effective, you mean it'll save parents time from taking off from work and or being out sick themselves, kids being out of school? Is that what you mean by cost effective?
Well, from a variety of standpoints, one is through decreased use of urgent care services, which are very expensive and account for a lot of the direct costs of asthma care. But then also looking at the indirect costs, such as missed parent work, missed school attendance, those other costs that are sometimes more difficult to assess. But certainly from an employer standpoint, we should be trying to get the best quality of asthma care that we can for all of our patients with asthma so that they are not having those sorts of decreased activities and loss of productivity.
Hal Farber, the rates of hospitalization for asthma differ throughout the state. Mm-hmm. And your part of the woods, your neck of the woods, Napa, Solano, tends to have, especially Solano County, fairly high hospitalization rates. Yeah. What accounts for those differences?
Actually, Solano County, interestingly, has one of the highest asthma prevalence rates, but doesn't have one of the highest hospitalization rates.
Oh, okay. I stand corrected.
One of the highest hospitalization rates is in Oakland.
So what accounts for that difference, do you think?
There are a number of things. One, in terms of driving asthma rates, we have issues of hygiene hypothesis, allergen exposure, and we also have issues in obesity, pollution, and recognition. Driving hospitalization rates, we have issues in both quality of care. We have issues in housing quality, environment, and what I would call poverty and environmental racism.
And when you say quality of care, you mean people get sicker before they see somebody? Is it an access question?
No, it's not an access question. It's focusing care on prevention rather than crisis care. Having an attitude that the way to prevent the next asthma, the way to treat an asthma crisis or an asthma attack is in part to prevent the next one. And once we have that linked, then we can really start much more approaching asthma control rather than just, I've got this crisis taken care of, bye, come see me with the next one.
David Nunez, from your position as chief of the California Asthma Public Health Initiative, what would you really like to see get done? What would make a difference in the short term?
Well, I think in the short term, again, I'd really like to see the healthcare system begin to adopt a lot of the high-quality interventions that we know are effective. And really, this is exactly what Hal's talking about. It's ensuring that everyone with asthma receives quality asthma care that includes good quality education so they understand what triggers their asthma, how the medications work, that they have a self-care plan. Many folks with asthma don't have an asthma management plan. Asthma is a chronic disease that many times you have to manage at home. So the self-care plan gives you a roadmap. It tells you what to do when you're sick, when you're your yellow zone or caution zone, and what to do when you're in the red zone, which is your urgent emergency zone. That's one thing. The other thing is I'd really like to see, again, more focus, as in diabetes and in heart disease, we have a focus on quality of care, not just prescribing the right medications, but whether or not you receive all the good quality things that you should be getting.
All right. David Nunez, chief of the California Asthma Public Health Initiative, thanks to you for being here. Thanks also to Dr. Hal Farber, pediatric pulmonologist at Kaiser Permanente in Napa, Solano. He's also the medical director of the Napa, Solano Pediatric Asthma Care Management Program. And thanks also to Bonnie Holmes-Jen, lobbyist for the American Lung Association of California. Well, we said at the beginning of the hour that millions of Americans suffer from allergies and asthma. And at the top of the show, we heard how one Californian learned he was allergic to pollen and barely survived to tell the story. So we're going to close with another story, the tale of writer Marissa Moss, who turned asthma into an opportunity.
I don't remember being diagnosed with asthma. That's because it happened when I was 2. Back then, there were no inhalers, no quick fixes. When I had an attack, the remedy was a sticky cough syrup that wasn't very effective. So being asthmatic meant having a doctor's note to excuse me from P.E. It meant my mother wouldn't let me join the Brownies for fear their hikes and campouts would do me in. I was small and skinny anyway, but my asthma left me feeling even more vulnerable, even less powerful. Except I had discovered a way I could be strong. A place where I could run and climb and perform amazing feats of endurance. In my head, and the world I invented in my stories, I could do anything. I started telling myself stories and drawing pictures to go with them from the time I could hold a crayon, about the same age I had that first asthma attack. I was drawn to the power of words and pictures, how with them I could make whatever I wanted to happen, happen. I told stories to my brother and sisters, and in their attentive faces I could see the weight, the heft of my words. It was magical. I couldn't bench press any pounds, but I could hold their attention, and to me that was a greater feat. Now, many years later, my asthma is controlled by 3 different inhalers plus 1 pill. I'm not weak anymore. In fact, I swim on a master's team 6 days a week. For someone who did no sports at all until long after college, I'm not bad. But what I'm really good at is stories. I kept on telling myself stories and drawing pictures to go with them until I got my first book published. I've now written more than 40 children's books. Each time I start a new one, I feel that same intense rush of wonder at the magic of words. How much they shape our experience of the world. So now I'm telling you a story of how a sickly asthmatic kid turned what could have been a barrier into a door. Sometimes I feel like I'm Harold with his magic purple crayon. I drew a way out of the box of asthma, and I told myself a good story along the way. For Health Dialogues, I'm Marissa Moss.
Marissa Moss is a writer living in Berkeley. If you missed any part of our discussion or want to listen to past programs, go to our website. It's californiareport.org, and then click on Health Dialogues. Health Dialogues is a production of the California Report and KQED Public Radio. Our staff includes director Susie Rocho, producer Erica Kelly, and intern Celia Harris. They're all allergic to cats and pollen. Thanks to KRCB engineer Mark Fuller in Santa Rosa. Our executive director, Raul Ramirez, and outreach director, Eric Gillespie, are allergic to dust. Senior producer, David Minko, avoids mold and penicillin. Our engineer, Danny Bringer, has asthma. His colleague, Howard Gelman, is allergic to horse serum, while engineer, Seal Muller, says she's only allergic to the early shift. We had help from Tamara Keith in Sacramento. Her husband is a veterinarian, but she's allergic to dogs and cats. Relieved that the worst of hay fever season is over, I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report's Health Dialogue series are provided by the California Endowment for coverage of healthcare in California and the members of KQED Public Radio.